Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, part two of our two-part conversation with retired sergeant, community policing educator, author, humanitarian, and justice advocate, founder of Black Cops Against Police Brutality, Dr. DeLacy Davis. I am Maggie B. Noen, and this is the Black Information Network Daily Podcast with your host, Ramses Ja.
You know, this is interesting, this intersection of, you know, all these various thoughts and areas of study and these societal and sociological checkpoints. Because, you know, you mentioned earlier about how Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in every city is always in the hood, right? And I was reading this might have been maybe sometime earlier this week, I was reading this, that that was intentional too. And that had to do with the, I think it was a facet of what we know of as redlining. Redlining, of course, is its own thing, but there were other less well-known instances of effectually the same thing, same practice, redlining, right? And that was a way to kind of delineate, naming it after Dr. King, naming the street after Dr. King was a way to delineate the black part of town from where your investments were more secure, right? In commercial real estate or in residential real estate. And then now we're talking about how all of these institutions and all these various facets of society, all of them, privilege white people and disadvantage black people, all of them. And, you know, it's interesting to make those connections at that point. And so I appreciate you kind of outlining that. This conversation so far has gone well beyond what I thought the boundaries would initially hold for me. But I don't want to keep the listeners waiting too much longer. You and I, we could talk forever. In fact, your comment about the two NFL players playing in the Super Bowl, for the first time is a conversation I had on my radio show, not 12 hours ago. Wow. So yeah. So, you know, we're right there, but Tyree Nichols, we need to talk about that. So, you've been very, outspoken and publicly have stated that, the incident with Tyree Nichols was a failure in responsibility, a failure in accountability, and a failure in integrity. So let's kind of peel back some layers there. What does that exactly mean for our listeners today?
So as a seasoned veteran police sergeant, when I think of what I saw on the video, however horrific it was, and it was, I have to look at it through an academic lens and a practitioner lens, right? And so folks like me, most of the generally the experts are criminologists who study the behavior of crime and the whole field. And then the practitioners are those that we're talking about, the police officers. I'm what we call a pracademic, right? I practice and I study. Mm-hmm. And so when I take a look at it, the question I ask for a unit like the Scorpion is, who is responsible for the unit? Mm-hmm. And we know ultimately it's the chief of police, but there's supposed to be a commander there, a commander over the unit, a captain, a lieutenant, a sergeant. Now the chief foreshadowed when she gave her interview that morning before we got the release of the videos, her first interview, I saw her interview and she foreshadowed these things that I'm raising now. And that was, we have a span of control issue. Now, she didn't tell the public what that meant, but I knew what it meant. There's a span of control that's considered reasonable for any supervisor, 6, maybe 7 people in your span of control. That's a lot, but maybe 5 to 6 is reasonable number of people to supervise. But I understand that in Memphis, the span of control is 10 or more, which means that you have somehow as a supervisor have to monitor what 10 people are doing. Yeah. That's a big number, especially when we're talking about folks with death on their side, right? They've got the ability to determine who lives and who dies. So who's responsible was the question I raised in terms of responsibility. The second thing was accountability. Well, people have to be held accountable. There was no supervisor anywhere on the radio taking control over the chase or the scene. So you don't have to be in the unit to take command and control. You simply need to be a supervisor. But now they had a duty to intervene, but that's a different conversation. As a supervisor in any division, the patrol division got supervisors there. No one said a word. And it is that silence that was golden for me, because I got 10 pages of notes that I'm taking. But what I'm also listening to is that no one is saying cut off the chase. No one is saying what's he wanted for. No one is saying the penalty for reckless driving is not the death penalty. Therefore, we don't need to commit this level of resources to finding someone whose car is left behind with a license plate on it and cameras everywhere to run them down and hunt them down. Like slave catchers, like a mob, like a posse, like a gang, like cops who have devolved, not evolved, but devolved into the same behavior that is the foundation of policing in America.
You know, there's something I want to add to this. And I said this on my same radio show, Civic Cypher. You know, you mentioned the Scorpion unit. And, you know, when I saw that video, I watch all those videos. Well, half of them, my co-host watches the other half because we don't want to become desensitized to, violence against black and brown bodies. But this one we both had to watch. Obviously we needed to speak about it. And one of the things that I took away from the video is that when I watched it, I didn't see. Well, rather, I saw 4 police officers, 5 police officers beating up Tyre Nichols, but I didn't see 4 black men, right? I know that it was black men punching and kicking and all that. But what I saw was a situation where there were police officers beating up a black man. And so the fact that there were these connections made that were, in my opinion, stretches, you know, as you mentioned, and people trying to interject that ludicrous narrative, that black on black narrative, the prevalence of black on black crime and so forth. In fact, the president of the Black Information Network had a conversation with me as he was talking to one of our advertisers saying that, well, that's a shame about Tyre Nichols. Black on black crime is just, someone needs to do something about black on black crime. When the fact of the matter is that what I saw were police officers being police officers, and using their advantages as police officers. As you mentioned, they have weapons. They can decide who lives and dies. They have a device they carry on their person. Whose only purpose is to end a life. It has no other function, only to end a life, and they carry it with them. And then they're beating, and you know, I can only imagine what those last moments are for Tyre of consciousness, what his life must have been like, not fully knowing, my imagination is he never knew what he was, why that was happening to him. With that in mind, I want to kind of peel back that a little bit more. And I think that you're just the person to do it. You wrote a book once upon a time called Black Cops Against Police Brutality, A Crisis Action in Plan. And I want you to tell us kind of the reason for writing that book and why that's important now and what readers can get from it now.
So I wrote the book because I knew I was going to retire in 20 years and not 25 because I'd had enough of policing as I had understood it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get out clean. And so I left with 50% of my pension and no medical, as opposed to staying 25 years and getting 70% of my pension and medical for life. But I said I would not leave the police department because when I started, I only planned to be there 10 years to do my music thing and go. So I did double what I said I would do. I said to myself as a goal, I would not leave until I left an instrument in place for the community before I left. And so that became the Crisis Action Plan, a how-to book on dealing with police violence, misconduct, and abuse, teaching our community how to develop a council of elders, helping young people understand when stopped by the police what to do on a motor vehicle stop, when they come knocking at the door, or when the police stop you on a street corner, helping them understand how to do an analysis quickly to know the difference between a war and a battle. A war is when you risk it all and you may lose it all, up to including your life. A battle is a fight that you can afford to walk away from, run from, hide from, and live to fight another day. So that was the basis for that. If we were, and we're now looking at doing another edition now, a revised edition, because that was released in 2006. And while I would say 75% of it is still relevant, there's the 25% that needs to be updated because it was pre-iPhone. It was gang enhanced penalty laws. It was pre a lot of those things, but the foundation of it was still solid, that when you have this kind of case. So for example, we did the Lionel Tate case. That's the 12-year-old in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, did the wrestling move, killed 6-year-old Tiffany Eunuch, and he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole by the judge at 12. Like, yes, he should be punished, but do we throw him away for life? And so we were involved in that case, and I flew down there 7 times, and I was recommended by a brother who I had locked up for drug addiction, for selling drugs, and he was now in a rehab clinic there trying to get clean from drug addiction, and he saw the mother and says, hey, there's a cop in New Jersey could help you. And so we got involved there, and 3 years later, after Johnny Cochran took the case, we did the appeal, we organized, and I walked Lionel out of jail on January 26, 2004. But it was not without a lot of help from a lot of people. And so I had to put in place what we call the Council of Elders, the folks that were going to be the go-to for his mother, Kathleen Grosset Tate, the person that she could trust, the people that would say to her when no one else would tell her what the truth is, tell her the truth, and then walk every bit of the walk with her. Hmm. So those are the things that were in the book. Hosiah Reynolds, who's, I know you asked, your producers asked me earlier about my first witnessing of police violence on my own department. Oh, well, Hosiah Reynolds was a young police officer in East Orange, New Jersey, had just gotten on the force, but he was walking down the street off duty in Elizabeth, New Jersey, a neighboring town, where he had tried to get on the force and they would never let him on. So they happened to see a gun, they say, and a badge, and they thought he had stolen it and was impersonating the police. So they grabbed him up on the street and beat him down on the street and then put him in a cell block with other inmates, even after they had his wallet, his gun, and his badge. And so while Hosiah Reynolds and I were not friends at all, I didn't like him and he didn't like me. When I found out about it, we protested, and we protested continually until he could get justice. And so we're friends to this day. He's a retired lieutenant, but he writes in the book at the very beginning, I couldn't stand this mofo, describing me, mm-hmm. and he couldn't stand me, but he was fighting for me like I was a relative of his, because that was also captured in the book. And then the next chapter is written by Sister Emma Jones, whose son Malik Jones was shot 19 times by the police in New Haven, Connecticut in 1997 on April 14th at the corner of Grand and Murphy. He's only accused of driving a car recklessly with his friend Samuel in the car. East Haven police officer Flotquist goes after him, chases him from East Haven to New Haven, and jumps out the car and reaches into the car to turn off the key. Every cop worth his salt knows not to put his hand in the window. And as a result, he gets dragged. He shoots Malik in the chest. After he fires the first shot, and his transcript said the following: I fired the first shot and he gave me a go to hell look. So I fired several more shots into his body. And I've been with that family and Sister Emma for years now. And so in the book, we have her write about it. She talks about meeting me as a police officer and her family being angry that she brought a black cop to their home after their son had been killed by a cop, not knowing that I would go the entire distance with that family. And it's only been in 2020 that we were able to get a civilian review board finally passed as a law in New Haven, Connecticut, when we started this journey in 1997 together.
We are here today with retired sergeant, community policing educator, author, humanitarian, and justice advocate, founder of Black Cops Against Police Brutality, Dr. DeLacy Davis, discussing the killing of Tyre Nichols by the Memphis PD, the history and evolution of policing in America, and why it is that cops are killing instead of protecting.
If I may, I want to kind of go off script a bit here. I saw the State of the Union address. Were you able to watch that?
I did watch it.
I was watching for one segment in particular when he got to talking about, you know, Tyre and police reform and so forth. And he said a few things. Actually, I have my notes from last night. Where are they? Okay. He wanted to increase training. And he wanted to develop higher standards for the officers. He wanted to have more first responders to address the growing mental health crisis and substance abuse issues. He wanted additional resources to reduce violent crime and gun crime. He wanted community intervention programs. And the one thing that stood out to me as being maybe less in the way of performative, if he actually were to follow through on it, and show to me that he had been listening, because full disclosure, I was a big fan of the ideas behind the Defund the Police initiative, the ideas of in terms of investing in community initiatives that really do impact crime rates, and doing that instead of giving police more money. We've seen, certainly in my city, police buying literally tanks. You know, nobody else has tanks, and, you know, it just kind of feels a little bit like overkill, literally. So when he said that he wanted to make investments in housing, education, and job training to have a real impact on crime rates, where there's actually been track records, proven track records that makes a difference. I want to get your thoughts on what President Biden said in terms of his addressing the issues pertaining to policing, in particular policing with respect to the Black community.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? Does the thought of social events make you feel excited or exhausted? It's easy for people to ignore their social batteries and spread themselves thin, especially at this time of year, when gatherings are picking up again after the winter. But it's important to find the right amount of socializing for you and still give yourself the time to recharge. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And when you're feeling worn out from socializing, therapy can help give you the tools you need to take care of yourself and recharge. Because a full battery is the key to a full life. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BIN today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BIN.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So let me say a lot of things.
Please.
We're talking about, very often we hear folks talking about treating the symptom and not the root cause. When people are hungry, they will do what they have to do to survive. When people are miseducated and don't know who they are, they will behave like what you designed them to be. When people cannot make a living wage, they will do what they need to do to supplement and take care of their families. That's the foundation of a lot of what we see. I adopted 4 children while on the police force as a single man. My mom helped me to raise them until her passing in 2012. The youngest child was 11 or 12, the oldest about 16, 17. My youngest adopted child is now 34 years old. My oldest is 40. I'm a girl dad, and I have 1 birth daughter who is 31. Those 4 children that my mother helped me bring in from the streets where I worked as a police officer, we changed the trajectory for the outcome of their lives. Mm. One was diagnosed bipolar, schizoaffective, violently molested by a family member. The other one oppositionally defiant. Father's doing life and mother has mental health challenges. I don't know how much better or worse, but I know that when I met my first adopted daughter, I was told that she would always need help. And they were right. And so she lived in 3 states in the last 4 months, four to six months. And she's finally just come back to New Jersey and I have her with her birth sibling. But I recognize the resources that we had to put in to try to keep her stable. The resources, the partial programs that you need, the love that she needs, the education that she needs. She's diagnosed with dyscalculia, means she has dyslexia with numbers. So now we've got to get specialists to come in and help her count, do mental math, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because she can't count that in her head. But she's brilliant. She's an actress. She can recite anything. She can memorize anything, right? That requires resources. Mm-hmm. And very often in our community, folks get frustrated when they come with challenges that have been created by that have never, ever responded to their needs, that have molested them culturally and in some cases physically. And then they begin to act out and you say, what's wrong? Some of this stuff is performative, I would agree, and topical. It doesn't drill down far enough. Mm-hmm. See, I would argue, give all the money you want to give to police departments, but make sure these programs are attached to the budget at a percentage rate. So therefore, when you give them more money, our programs get more money. Mm-hmm. We're fortunate enough to do programming. I run an agency now. We provide support, education, and advocacy to parents of children with special needs. And we're peer support and we're certified. Why? Because we know what you're going to be up against when you have a special needs child. Likewise, folks that are trying to make it across this country, particularly in marginalized communities, one of the greatest things is they don't have access. We do not have access. We don't have the same resources. The resources don't look the same. And I teach at a university here in New Jersey. And one of the things I teach in the School of Public Affairs and Administration, I'm teaching this semester about civics and social responsibility and democracy. And I'm talking about what is the difference between those students who are faring well and those who struggle. It's not because you're smarter. It's because you've had access to more resources. It's just like we say about us, the generational wealth that we don't get to pass on. We don't get to pass it on because we've never had it accumulate. Mm-hmm. And even those that accumulate wealth don't know what to do because we're so young at handling money. So it becomes, for me, a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, I think about solutions. So one of the things on my list, I've got solutions at the federal, state, and local level that we've looked at. One of them is demilitarizing the police.
Okay.
I agree with you. What do you need a tank for? I agree with you. You don't need a tank. But also, what kind of service delivery do we get in our community? So let's not call the police for social work stuff. You know, my critics on the police force when I was in East Orange used to say to me, you know, if you want to be a social worker, you should turn in your gun and badge and go do social work, because we like busting heads around here and you're going against what we believe in.
Wow.
And so, you know what I had to say to them? Well, I'm going to just have to testify against you when you bust a head in front of me. And you can bust as many heads as you like, but if you bust it in front of me, I'm going to testify against you. And on two occasions, that's exactly what I did. I took my phone number, wrote it down, and stuck it into the hand of the person that was being assaulted. Call me. I witnessed it. And the time when I testified against a Black police officer, Internal Affairs told him that I was the one testifying against him. So he left Internal Affairs and came straight after me, gun blazing, in the lobby where I got prisoners, because I'm on a prison transport detail, and everybody that saw it swore they didn't see anything. So I went straight to the lieutenant. So you're going to tell me you didn't see that guy chasing me around, threatening to kill me? You didn't see me running while I left those 12 inmates standing there? Well, Davis, you're going to have to put it on paper. I will. Are you going to validate it? And so I wound up going to trial. They downgraded it from aggravated assault to simple assault, found guilty in court, but the judge would not take his job. And so that made me a pariah in the institution. And I understood that's a risk. Yeah. So there's some real things. Like, one of my solutions at the federal level is whistleblower protection for good police officers. Mm-hmm. Where does a good cop go? Yeah. If Sammy the Bull Gravano could kill 19 people for Gotti, and you say, we'll forgive all 19 if you give us John, then why won't you let officer A, B, C, and D get the same level of protection, witness protection, if I give up this corrupt agency that I'm in? Because granted, I won't be able to work here anymore. This one is a wrap. You can stick a fork in me. I'm done. Folks ask me all the time, do you miss the police department? No, because I still do the same work I was doing. I'm just doing it in the community for the community. It is power to the people. It belongs to the people. Sir Robert Peel had 9 Peelian principles. And the one that I like most, he says that the public are the police and the police are the public. He just wasn't talking about Black people at that time, right? He was talking about Europeans. Mm-hmm. But that's right. It just doesn't get practiced in our community by us. And so, yeah, so some of the solutions, yes, we need mental health issues addressed. I just talked about 2 of my children.
Sure.
We need supports. If we didn't have Medicaid, I wouldn't have anything for them. I couldn't afford to pay it out of pocket. More increased training. You don't need more training. How do you untrain a racist? How do you train a Negro to hate being Black to want to be Black?
That's what I've been saying.
Help me with that training program. And I train. I taught the academy, right? We can't train that. That's home training or lack thereof. That's what that is. I know some Black officers. I know some Black people that hate being Black, and I know some white people that would sacrifice much more for Black people than a Black officer.
That too, that way.
And that's my reality, right? So we can't untrain that. Community intervention programs, yeah, that can work. In Newark, we have violence interrupters. Brothers and sisters who wreaked havoc on the community when they were before they went down, who have now come back and been hired by a progressive mayor, and they're actually interrupting violence. I went into an island for a year to do gang prevention and intervention. And when I went, knowing they hired me as a police officer, and it was a decent contract, they said, well, Brother DeLacy, you know, how are you going to deal with gangs? You've never been a gang member. You're right. I'm going to bring the former leader of the Crips and the former leader of the Bloods with me. I have those relationships and continue to have them. They refer to me as Uncle D. One young man that went with us, when he went, he had dropped out of community college. When he came back, he says, I never saw Black men so educated who was so committed to the community. Made me want to go back to school. He went back and got his associate's degree. He then got a bachelor's degree. He now has a master's degree, and both of his children are doing well in private schools. He came from the streets. And he tells that story. So when I do my male mentoring program in the summer, he comes every year. He said, I owe it to Uncle D. He said, because he exposed me to Dr. Linworth Gunther, Jamaican brother, African studies in New Jersey. Dr. Tyrone Powers, Eyes of My Soul, former FBI agent. Eyes of My Soul, The Rise and Decline of a Black FBI Agent. Dr. Andre Bundley, down in Baltimore, Maryland. Coach Alfred Powell, Dayton, Ohio. Sheriff Rochelle Bilal, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Val Robinson, D.C. I mean, these are the folks. These are the solution sets. These are the folks that have been on the front line 10, 15, 20, 30 years with the solution. Cheryl Dorsey called me last night after listening to the president talk about solutions. She says, hey, we understand that certainly the loss of a child at the hands of the police is horrible. But you're treating parents like rock stars, knowing that all somebody is doing is pimping their pain. They are those of us that do this work that could come to the table with you, with them, and say, this is what it should look like.
Here's the solutions. Exactly. Exactly. You know, there's and I know your time is short, but briefly, there's the performative, the talking points, the you know, hitting those greatest hits that everybody can get behind, increased training, that sort of thing. Knowing, you know, from my position, knowing that police training has been a talking point for decades and has actually been implemented and has not made any real measurable impact on outcomes for Black people, Black bodies in particular. It lets me further know that, you know, there is a disconnect. But there was that one bright moment that, again, suggested that some of the ideas behind those campaigns we saw in 2020 did make their way to the president's desk. He did reflect upon them, or at least his speechwriter did, and they made their way into the State of the Union address. Let me know that, okay, you know, we don't always get what we want in the time that we want it, but, you know, our story is one of baby steps. You know, we pick up where our ancestors left off and we carry, you know, the burden a little bit further, and we leave it to our children to carry it a bit further, such as the life that we live in this country. But there were a couple of bright moments. I called it a mixed bag. There were a couple of bright moments and a couple of things that I thought were absolutely performative. But that's perhaps the nature of politics. I'm not a politician. So, you know, who knows? You know, leave that to the politicians. But, you know, I think that we've done a good job of voicing our concerns, as illustrated by the fact that we were able to hear them read back to us during that State of the Union. So I'm glad that that was present. I'm glad to hear your takeaways from it. Certainly your ideas are extremely insightful and worth a whole another installment of our podcast today, but I know your time is short. So before we let you go, I'd love to get you to plug your book, Black Cops Against Police Brutality, A Crisis Action Plan. And of course, let our listeners know how we can support your other initiatives, how we can tap in with you on social media, websites, et cetera. Let's make sure we download all that content before we let you go.
Sure. So I'm everywhere as DeLacy Davis or Dr. DeLacy Davis. The website is drdelacydavis.com. That's drdelacydavis.com. And I'm everywhere as DeLacy Davis, all over social media, Facebook, Twitter, the Gram, everywhere. The book is Black Cops Against Police Brutality, A Crisis Action Plan. Also, there's the most recent piece. I'm in chapter 4 of this book, Why the Police Should Be Trained by Black People, edited by Dr. Natasha Pratt Harris, as Why the Police Should Be Trained by Black People. And our chapter, which I'm a co-author, is Help Without Harm, Black Police Officers as Trainers. And what we maintain is that just because you're Black doesn't mean you're qualified to train in our community. You need to have had a Black experience that the community validates, and then you can come train in our community.
That way. Listen, you are a good man, and you are an inspiring man. And I started doing this show because I felt that I didn't need to introduce the next Cardi B record anymore, that I had my time, I had my fun, and now I needed to make an impact. I'm raising two sons, and this felt a lot more meaningful for me. Today's conversation with you has made the journey even more worth it. I did all this stuff with the Black Information to talk with you today. Chris will tell you that. Chris will validate that. Maggie will validate that. This conversation matters to me, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me on this show today. And of course, I appreciate you for sharing your insight and your general overall commitment to the authentic, informed, safe, and inspired future of our Black community. Once again, today's guest is retired sergeant, community policing educator, author, humanitarian, and justice advocate, founder of Black Cops Against Police Brutality, Dr. Lacey Davis.
Thank you, brother. Peace to the family.
I'm Maggie B. Nowen, and today I'll leave you with this. The burden of fatal police violence is an urgent public health crisis in the United States. Fueled by billions of dollars in local, state, and federal funding, and political support from Democrats and Republicans alike, 2022 was the deadliest year on record for police violence since 2013, when experts first started collecting the data. Beyond the issue in itself of individuals being harmed and even murdered by those who we have entrusted with our safety and our leadership, what we see across the media, in our real-life observances, and now consistently in ever-mounting evidence from a wide variety of studies and sources, that the deaths at the hands of the police disproportionately impact certain races and ethnicities, and disproportionately impact Black people and the Black community, pointing huge red arrows to systemic racism being alive and well in policing. How many more hashtags? How many more protests? How many more tears? How many more funeral t-shirts? And how many more dollars to pay not just for the funerals, but to pay off police department legal settlements? Enough is enough. We must challenge the status quo and demonstrate to the perpetrators what good trouble looks like. Educated and inspired by Dr. Davis's commitment to the cause, and in honor of our brother Tyree, in celebration of his life, and in honor of the too many others whose lives have been stolen by the police, let us commit to living out their legacies to the best of our abilities, leaving today's conversation again, not mad, but motivated. Motivated to audacious action, to loving more, to loving louder, to dismantling anything and everything set up to delude, harm, or hold us back. Motivated to calling out and canceling the killer cop culture every chance we get. This has been a production of the Black Information Network. Today's show is produced by Chris Thompson. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, use the red microphone talkback feature on the iHeartRadio app. We'd love to hear from you. While you're there, be sure to hit subscribe and download all of our episodes. Find your daily podcast host at Ramses Jah on all social media. We look forward to your joining us tomorrow as we share our news with our voice from our perspective, right here on the Black Information Network Daily Podcast.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.